Hi, I'm David Korn.
And I'm Jim Pinkerton.
And together,
we're Blogging Heads TV, yet again.
Well, you know, if the demand's there, more than two people want to watch.
Or even if it's not, the supply is there at least.
Yeah, supply. It's one way or the other. Well, speaking of supply and demand, there was a demand of votes. I'm not sure there's a supply today when George Bush, for only the second time in his presidency, went up to the Senate Republican luncheon, which is held on most Tuesdays when they are in session, to talk to or perhaps plead with fellow Republicans to pass his immigration bill, or the one that he's gotten behind. Do you think that he has any influence, any power of persuasion left at this point in his bedraggled presidency?
I think that Bush is, I mean, obviously, as the opinion polls show, you know, most Americans, 65-70% or so, peeled away on issues like Iraq and U.S. attorneys and, you know, whatever else. So they were never for to begin with. I think the two elements of his base that he had remaining until the last couple of weeks were, one, the hardcore neocons, who he's now alienated them because he hasn't pardoned Scooter Libby yet.
Not yet.
We'll talk about this some other time. But that's a big chunk of, like, the neocon group has trashed Bush in pretty harsh terms over Scooter Libby. And then the other bigger part of the base, numerically at least, if not intellectually, was the sort of standard conservatives who sort of the Rush Limbaugh types who simply stuck with Bush on Iraq and so on and so on. But they, almost to a man and a woman, have peeled away over the immigration bill. They're the same mentality that has you supporting Bush on Iraq does not have you supporting open borders. And so I think that the challenge Bush now has is he's really, the only people who still sort of like him are those who think he might be a winner. And when I say winner, I mean,
what do you mean?
As in, he might pass legislation. There's some people in politics who simply like to be on the side of the cool victory, the big win. And I'm thinking of people like Arlen Specter.
Right.
And Mitch McConnell and Trent Lott and John Boehner, who sort of like being in the room. Mm-hmm. Now, their problem is even they have now concluded after the immigration bill collapsed, at least for the first time last week, that Bush is probably not going to win. And so the one thing they don't want to do is get strung out a second time on a losing effort, because if your whole raison d'etre in politics is to be on the winning side, or at least be part of the winning team, it's no fun to be part of the losing
team.
Now,
they should maybe take a cue from me. Because I've decided, when it comes to this immigration bill, I don't care. They fooled me once last year and got me all worked up about immigration policy. I studied the stuff and had all my views and facts at my fingertips, and then it went nowhere. And they ginned it up again, and the last week it collapsed, and now they're coming back and saying, really, 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 it's not dead yet. It's like the parrot in Monty Python. This is an ex-parrot.
It's a pining for the fjords.
It's not pining for the fjords. It's an ex-parrot. And I just refuse to be suckered in again. Bush could come to Capitol Hill and put on a hula hoop and do cartwheels on his head. I just can't see it working. There are enough, pardon the technical term, yahoos out there who believe this is amnesty and want to ship 12 million people back in buses and, the talk shows that are going to put enough fear into Republicans. There are enough Republicans with legitimate concerns. And there's certainly enough Democrats, and I put myself in this camp, who have concerns or opposition to the guest worker provision. I mean, this is America. I think, if you work, you're a worker. And, I don't like this two-tier system here. I just can't see someone like George Bush, who at this point couldn't walk through a flooded disaster zone and get it right by offering to, tie someone's shoes who was lying in front of him. I can't see him pulling this off.
Unless it was Albania.
We'll get to Albania in a second. That's how far he had to travel to get applause.
Speaking as someone who supports the wall, who worries a lot about national sovereignty, and also opposes the guest worker provision for exactly the reasons you say. I think you should be a worker in this country. Abraham Lincoln was right. Mm-hmm. There should be free labor in this country. No slave labor, no indentured servitude, mm-hmm. or anything like that. I think Bush has badly miscalculated this, but I would just point out how rapidly, and in my reckoning. Pleasingly, the issue has shifted, because remember, last year it was a Republican Congress that's presumably, well, who knows what their position is on immigration reform, but this year it's a Democratic Congress, which is sworn, with Teddy Kennedy leading the way, to you know, comprehensive, humanitarian, family reunifying immigration reform. And they don't dare touch it, which only tells me how that Democrats, who are all worried about getting reelected in swing states, don't dare vote for anything that looks like amnesty, because whether you call them yahoos or I call them citizens and concerned citizens, this issue is changing rapidly. I think that the gestalt coming
I still think that the amnesty point is being demagogued. And if you know, if you ask people if you think people who are here illegally should have a path to citizenship, you have like a 62% approval rating of that notion. If you ask them if they should be given amnesty, it drops to 45%.
I mean, well, so on the other hand, you have the problem with these indigenous words, amnesty, not amnesty, indigenous words. Mm-hmm. The reality is this: the reality is that those three men who were foreign born, who had U.S. residency in the Fort Dix Six, had between them 75 run-ins with the law, traffic tickets, parking tickets, drunk driving arrests, and so on, in the last 20 years, and nothing happened to them.
Well, that really is not material.
Sure,
why is it to what we're talking about here?
It means that when you take that plus the case of the guy, the TV tort lawyer who came across the border in New York, and the case of the Washington Post cited, which is where the Department of Homeland Security had done a study and said that with using fake ID, the Homeland Security experts have gotten
But you're talking about means of enforcement. You're not talking about
the enforcement mechanism is so shot.
Well, sure, yeah.
If it's so defective, then nobody trusts anybody. Nobody trusts the government to legalize in an orderly way 12 million people.
Well, nevertheless, you know, I don't think most Americans want to ship them back. I think most Americans would like to find a way to bring them, you know, into the above ground economy. Maybe some Americans don't, because they get cheaper labor if they stay slave, you know, instead of in fear of being arrested. But nevertheless, I think, you know, the American notion here is to try to bring these people into the American community. But I would not say that you can, you know, that this should be done in a shoddy manner. It should be done as well as possible. Unfortunately, we have government bureaucracies in charge of this, as with everything else, and the Department of Homeland Security and the guys who do airport security, it's always going to be problematic.
It doesn't have to be. I mean, we did a pretty good job of winning World War II. If you really put your mind to it, you can get a good bureaucracy going.
We did a pretty good job of winning World War II because Hitler attacked Russia. It would have been a lot different.
Well, I mean, we also built, we're building 35 aircraft carriers a year by the end of the war. We can't even build an armor plate for our vehicles.
Right.
Look, it's painfully obvious to most Americans that this president, frankly, this Congress, Democrat and Republican alike, has not put a very high priority on border security and immigration control. And we see the results of that all around us. We see, you know, odd cases like in Colorado Springs just the other day.
This is a country of nearly 300 billion people. It's a dynamic country. We have people coming and going all the time. You know, you can point to, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, even 20 cases. And, you know, you're talking about still 0.0001%. You know, you're a smart guy. You know you can't design a foolproof system. Now, I'm not saying this to excuse the screw-ups, like with the Fort Dix 6 or whatever. But, you know, there will always be something for the Rush Limbaughs to point to and say, look, you know, we can't even do this, so let's keep everybody out. Let's throw everybody out. We have to be mature adults and know that in any system, you can have 5%, you know, inefficiencies and screw-ups.
Well, after 9/11, that's a harder argument to make, because 9/11 told us that only 19 people can do a lot of damage.
Yeah, well, you still can't have 100, you know, in a society this big, and you and I both know that come tomorrow, any terrorist with an ounce of brains who was so dedicated could pull off something tomorrow without being thwarted by any, no matter how good the system was.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that, and I know the American people don't, and I know the American people expect us to work as hard on Homeland Security as they do about, say, arranging congressional
hearings. Listen, you know, you could be fully, you could have no track record with any law enforcement authority here. Go somewhere, you know, get a couple of semi-automatic guns, get automatic weapons, and walk into a campus, perhaps, maybe an elementary school, maybe a Mall of America, and kill a couple hundred Americans just like that.
You could, but David, but that doesn't seem to be the pattern.
No, no, it doesn't.
The pattern usually is these people, including the guy at Virginia Tech a couple months ago, have a fair amount of interface with the law before they commit their terrorist attack. Of the 19 hijackers on 9/11, 11 of the 19 were, quote, out of status, unquote. They'd done something that violated their green card or residency status that should have had them thrown out of the country then. Now, either we figure this stuff out or we don't. But if we don't figure it out, if we just simply make excuses for the government and the bureaucrats, then the American people and Rush Limbaugh have a perfect right to say, we don't trust you with any plan for legalizing 12 million people, especially when the Senate votes, as they did, not to exclude people who've been convicted of felonies from consideration.
Listen,
to become citizens.
I want to get to Albania, but I think my point stands that, we should. I think you and I can agree. Let's find what we can agree on. We should have the system should work better. Agreed?
The system should work better. There should be no guest workers.
Okay, no guest workers. We agree on that.
And do you agree, David, there should be a wall?
I am not a wall fan.
Issue to have an election on.
No, we'll see. At any event, let's move on to Albania. Why was the president in Albania?
He needs friends.
What?
He needs friends.
and do you think, I mean, at this point in his presidency, now it's probably fun not to be in Washington, but why go through all the bother to go to Albania? I mean, seriously,
The president is looking legacy.
Legacy. I laugh anytime anyone says legacy with President Bush, but go ahead.
They all think that way, and all presidents, that is. And they all start looking around for things they can do, and I think Bush's speech in Prague, where he said that the Soviets and the Chinese have derailed democracy and so on, I think was a bad speech made for legacy purposes. I think what we're up against now is that as the president struggles to make a legacy, he is doing things that harm American foreign policy.
Explain your point why you thought it was a bad speech. But let me just say right now that if the guys in the White House think that they can affect his legacy at all by making speeches at this point, they are so sorely mistaken. But that actually worries me because it makes me think they may even be delusional.
It could be the phrase post hoc ergo propter hoc, whereby if someday in the future China and Russia become democratic, the Bush people, the Bush legacy The legacy cops can say, see, that speech that Bush gave in June of 07, that was the linchpin. That was the key moment. That was the decisive thing.
I go back to delusional. But why do you think that speech was problematic?
Well, I think that if we're trying to get the Russians and the Chinese to cooperate with us on crucial concerns like Iran,
right,
then we shouldn't be making them mad on tangentially.
Didn't Bush invite Putin to spend July 4th with him at Kenny Bunkport or someplace like that? It seems to me if you're inviting someone over your house, the last thing you want to do before they get there is dish them. Maybe do it after they left, but the timing of this was kind of weird.
I agree. It's like Cheney went to, I think it was Lithuania
there.
Yeah, and he went to Lithuania and said the Russians were using blackmail on the natural gas pipeline. Well, of course they are. But the point is, how many enemies can we have at once? Do we want Russia and China de facto helping Iran and Iraq and the insurgents in Iraq and so on, or do we not? And I'll give you another example that was sort of striking to me, is that the president laid a wreath at the tomb of the Bulgarian unknown soldier. Now, I've never been to Bulgaria, and I've never been to this monument. I know enough history to know that Bulgaria fought with the Central Powers in World War I and fought with the Nazis in World War II. So I was kind of wondering, who's this Bulgarian soldier?
It's like a Bitburg type deal?
Exactly. And
what did you find?
I looked it up, and it appears to me that the tomb of the Bulgarian unknown soldier actually dates only to 1981, so it's relatively recent, honors the Bulgarians who fought in wars against the Turks in the 1870s. There's a couple wars of liberation against the Ottoman Empire back then, which only makes me think a little bit as we're trying to get Turkey to keep cool.
Which Turkey just invaded the Kurdish part of Iraq the other day.
Or shelled it at least, or who knows what, who knows, exactly. I mean, it would seem that you would think this would not be the most opportune moment to surely antagonize the Turks over Bulgaria, which is, after all, a neighbor, as an adjoining country to Turkey.
I think this is probably what happened. I think the White House put out an RFP, for those of you who don't live in Washington, that's a request for a proposal, it's a bureaucratic term, for a wreath-laying operation involving the President of the United States. And they got one RFP in, Bulgaria. We have a tomb here, no one knew. But I agree with you. It's completely ridiculous that he's going off and doing this. I don't think it has any impact on anyone except maybe the Lithuanians and the Turks and the Albanians and the Bulgarians who pay attention. Here, he still is Mr. Irrelevant, except, of course, there's that little war going.
Well, I would say, but just to correct, I agree with the thrust of what you're saying, but I would say this. If Bush says Kosovo ought to be independent, says as a flat statement, Kosovo ought to be independent, then just the might of the United States being what it is, it's pretty likely that Kosovo is going to be independent sooner rather than later. And I noticed that the Serbian leader, who's democratically elected, oddly enough, has the same exact position on Kosovo independence that Milosevic had. In other words, Serbian nationalism, independent of a democratic system or not, is simply such that they don't want their country to be broken apart. And the Russians, crucially, don't either. And I find it hard to imagine that even if Bush charms the hell out of Putin at kind of Bunkport, which I don't think he will, because Putin's a pretty tough cookie.
You don't think a war skiing runner by the compound is going to do the trick? You've probably been there.
I have, and I will also tell you this. I mean, look, I think Putin is as smart an operator in world politics as there is as anywhere in the world. And I think going back to the time that he appears to have suckered the president in Slovenia 6 years ago now, when he said, when Bush was so famous that I went to the soul and realized he was a good Christian. Anyway, I shudder to think at how Putin is preparing what new line he's going to use to bamboozle Bush with at Kenny Bunkport, as opposed to vice versa.
Maybe he'll be talking about Bush's legacy. You are great president, Mr. Bush. You are misunderstood, Mr. Bush. Well, let's cross the aisle here. It's not really a full crossing of the aisle. It's maybe a half step, and talk about another warmonger, and that would be Joe Lieberman, who used to be a Democrat, and the other day came out and basically advocated bombing Iran. It seems to me that this falls into the Jim Pinkerton strategic concept. We call it the Pinkerton Doctrine, which is when you're being screwed somewhere, don't go looking for more enemies. I'm not sure if Metternich or Bismarck ever put it so eloquently, Mr. Pinkerton, but I mean, it seems to me that this is, again, here we have, the Bush administration, 7 months too late, saying that the Baker-Hamilton-Iraq study group report might be worth giving a shot. They're reaching out and trying to talk to Iran, seeing if they can, make it be less a negative force in the region and, find some ways to, stabilize Iraq. And there were just meetings a week or two back. There are more meetings ahead. And here comes Lieberman basically saying, we probably should go in and just start bombing them. Do you think he did that in coordination with anybody, or is that just Joe talking?
I think that's Joe Mentum right there.
Joe Mentum?
Remember that from the 2004 campaign? He was on his way to finishing, I think, sixth in Iowa. He was telling his fans, I have Joe Mentum. Yeah. I'm sure Lieberman believes that the U.S. should bomb Iran, just like he believes the U.S. should stay in Iraq until we win. This is just his neocon view, and it's sort of hard for me to believe that he's going to end his days inside the Democratic Party at the rate he's going. I have no doubt that they're planning to invite him to speak at the Republican convention in Minneapolis, or St. Paul, wherever it is, next year. And I wouldn't be surprised if he shows up, frankly, just to give a speech endorsing the Republican who will then promise to invade Iran. I don't think it's a particularly good idea, and I must say maybe that I'm not sure it'll happen.
Maybe at the convention he and McCain can sing Bomb, Bomb, Bomb Iran together. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go to YouTube.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, anybody didn't see McCain singing that song, can find it on YouTube. There's something has changed in American politics where senior people, like the president, like the vice president, like the Democratic chairman of the Homeland Security Committee and a prominent figure in the Democratic Party the last couple decades, they seem to think that talking, back to your point earlier about speeches, is the same thing as doing something. I mean, there's actually such a thing as diplomacy where you kind of keep quiet and you surprise people by what you're doing.
Right.
You say, wow, who knew they could do that? Who knew they could pull off that alliance? You know, it makes you nostalgic. Right, David, for like Henry Kissinger.
I was going to say Nixon because he's dead. You can be nostalgic for Nixon. Kissinger's still with us. I have no nostalgia for Henry Kissinger.
Well, I mean, but nonetheless, I can remember as a little kid reading the paper that Henry Kissinger was like got sick in Pakistan. He's like he had a flu.
And you were worried. You were concerned.
I was worried about him. And then it turned out he'd actually snuck away to China for a couple days. But that's good politics. That's smart. That's diplomacy.
Right.
And it'd be nice for once if Americans could say, you know, look, we're going to work quietly behind the scenes to somehow close off Iran, to embargo Iran, to do whatever it took, and through clever and shrewd diplomacy and strategery, we have gotten China and Russia to help us. We are light years away from doing that. In fact, we're moving the opposite direction.
Now, do you think, you know, this comes from the top and that it's sort of Bush's nature, you know, not to be so subtle or nuanced as John Kerry might say in France.
I think it's clearly some of that in Bush, but I think it's the whole neocon style.
Mm-hmm.
You get up and you make a speech saying, "We have reread history in the way that, in our good Trotskyite way, and we've concluded by the ineluctable laws of nature and force and so on. This is what's got to happen." Yeah. And then we tell everybody. We make proclamations. I think the neocons betray themselves as the professors and propagandists that they once were, because even in government, they can't stop themselves from, as it were, writing articles and pamphlets to each other and to the public and
I mean, I still go back to Bush's second inaugural speech, where he says, you know, wherever you are fighting for democracy, you know, I stand with you, which is certainly a lie. I mean, you know, in print and sentiment, sure, yeah, but, you know, what are we doing for, you know, for people locked up in China? What are we doing for Tibet? You know, we cut deals all the time. We were cutting deals with Uzbekistan until we got a base next door in another one of the stands. I mean, they would come out with these, you know, lovely-sounding pronouncements, not realizing that in some way they were doing more harm than good, because they were showing the limitations of power and one's own hypocrisy. I mean, you know, one can still call for democracy and praise it, and, you know, I've always been, you know, an advocate of human rights in foreign policy matters. But it's also a matter of how you approach things and how you do it, and I think you're right. You know, pamphleteering and grand proclamations are not a substitution for action and getting things done.
Right. What gets things done in this world overall is it sounds horrible and boring to say. It's like process.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take this case to XYZ court. We're going to have evidence. Mm-hmm. We're going to pull together facts and data and statistics and so on, and assemble a mound of information about this or that or whatever. It's patient and boring and for nerds, but it mm-hmm. works, and it doesn't cause a backlash.
Well, I mean,
anybody who's curious ought to go back and look at that second inaugural speech of Bush, where this is almost a quote, said, "The untamed fire of freedom will burn the world." Now that is, shall we say, not a conservative thought. That's the kind of thought one associates with, like, The Nation magazine.
Oh, a Mel Gibson movie. It sounds apocalyptic.
It does sound apocalyptic.
Yeah.
So it could be either, right. It's something, it's radical. It's something other than Aristotle and Burke and all those other conservative heroes saying, look, do things, and von Mises, do things slow, Hayek, do things slowly and prudentially and carefully.
But this is, you know, it reminds me of a title of a book called Hubris. But just, you know, the self-confidence that one has, that one can change the world in such a bold way with shortcuts, in essence. You know, not by doing the hard, heavy lifting and figuring out how to get from A to Z through all the steps in between, but by just saying through force of will, you know, we're just going to, you know, bend things to our liking. And even if the liking is, is a positive thing, you know, it's, to me, it's a real misreading of the way things work and a real over, a sense of, you know, of over arrogance that you can do things with a snap of a finger because you're right.
Why bother teaching American soldiers Arabic, for example?
Yeah.
When you can just bomb Iraq.
But I tell you, you know, we've seen the limitations of all this in Iraq and in other matters we've been talking about. This is nothing compared to the limitations we're going to see in the coming decades as we have to deal with China.
I agree. You know, the Chinese are watching closely all the time.
I mean, all the challenges that China proposes, and I don't want to, fall into, yellow hoardism, but all the challenges and the way they're going to have an impact on the world and our world are not going to be addressable by the tools and mechanisms that this gang has deployed so far.
I agree with that, too, and I will point to, I've read recently in the Financial Times, and I've read many articles like this, quoting some Chinese economics minister saying, look, you Americans produce, I think it's 6 or 8 times as much CO2 per person as we do, so why don't you fix the global warming problem based on your own greenhouse gas emissions, and then come to us and tell us how we can work together. But do your own thing first. Right. Now, needless to say, that's a hard sell. I mean, the Germans and the Swedes might agree to that, but I don't think America ever will. And again, that's going to require diplomacy and negotiation and language skills and cultural simpatico and all the things that America, at least at better times, has possessed and seems to have neglected to get anywhere on what I think we would both agree is a big issue for the 21st century.
And we just saw what happened at the G8 summit where Bush was left isolated yet again. And none of this is going to get to that second wave challenges of after the United States and the industrialized nations of Europe and Japan deal with the issue, how to get China and India, which are quickly catching up, aboard as well. And it's just not going to come about. They're not going to do the right thing because George Bush makes a wonderful speech in the Ukraine.
Right.
Before we say goodbye today, let's bring it on home. Bring it on home. And that is, I don't think you and I have talked since the last round of presidential debates. There was a Democratic debate and a Republican debate. We don't have to go over that. But let's look at some of the recent news. Two questions I have for you. Why do you think about Fred the Foreign Agent Thompson? I'll explain that in a moment if people don't understand. And are you still hot for Huckabee? The day before that, he said that, most prisoners in America would love to be in Guantanamo. The type of remark that just makes you think you can't be that dumb. So anyway, those are the two questions I throw to you, Thompson and Huckabee.
Well, I'll let you cover the point. Let's just talk about Fred Thompson, what you're saying about
the story in the Washington Post that came out. We all knew that Fred Thompson, for 20 years on and off, had been a lobbyist here in Washington, making, a couple million dollars, working for several firms, which I thought ran against his folks, the image he's trying to cultivate now as a folksy guy who wants to run against the Beltway. He was really what we call here in Washington a Gucci-wearing lobbyist. Jeffrey Birnbaum in the Post had a story that showed that in the last 3 years, he made $760,000 working for this company called Equitas, which is a British reinsurance company. Don't ask me to explain reinsurance, but I do know that they're facing billions of dollars in claims related to asbestos, and there may be legislation on the Hill here in Washington that will decrease their liabilities. And he's been working. What is he doing? He's squeezing people like Bill Frist, who's, you know, who was Senate Majority Leader, for information. He's a fellow Tennessean, like Fred Thompson, and bringing it back to Equitas. He doesn't have to actually register as a foreign agent or, I think, as a lobbyist, but he's doing all this sort of strategic planning, using his own connections on the Hill to help his company get out of these claims. And it just isn't what you think of when you think of a folksy guy running on Tennessee in a red pickup truck. And I blogged about it mainly because the Post put the story on page 823. I thought it was front page material. But, you know, it certainly, you know, cuts against that, you know, the character that he wants to play in the movie called 2008 Fred's Year.
Well, I do think that Thompson is not quite the great right hope that people say he
Why
is.
Not?
For the reasons you say, plus the fact that he was only a senator and nobody really thinks an overly accomplished senator. And he's, you know, been married a time or two and I mean, has lived, you know, as he said in that statement, you know, girls used to chase me and I used to let them catch me. Yeah. You know, I mean, just as the entire story of Thompson unfolds, and I'm no prude and I wouldn't vote against him just because he enjoyed a high lifestyle, you know. But I do think the cumulative portrait is of somebody who's not, shall we say, Reagan. You know, something different. And so I would just say that, expanding on this, that the Republican field now is genuinely wide open. I think the polls tend to show Giuliani still in the lead, and then depending on state by state, nation, and which poll is national poll, you see McCain, Thompson and Romney kind of in a bunch somewhere in the teens or low 20s in there, someplace like that. So which tells me that anytime you have a race where there are three or four people who can plausibly say they're within striking, they're leading or within striking distance of leading, then you have a genuinely wide open contest.
You know, the interesting thing is that there's a Bloomberg LA Times poll out that says that Giuliani has 27% and Thompson has 21%, undeclared Fred Thompson, and McCain and Romney run well behind. So Thompson, who's not yet in, is quickly, you know, if his polls could be believed, has quickly moved into second place amongst Republicans. But I agree with you. I think, you know, it's like a blind date. They often seem better before before the meal's over, and you know, Thompson is coming in as a law and order movie star. He talked about in the same breath as Ronald Reagan again and again by his advocates and by pundits, and there's really nowhere for him to go but down at this point. He's had the stage to himself after the last Republican debate, which he didn't participate in. He did 30 minutes on Fox News and got nothing but softball questions from Sean Hannity. He was on Hannity and Combs, but he didn't last, you know, but Combs wasn't even on the set for the interview. And so he looked presidential. It's going to be a lot different when he's one of 11 Republicans, all getting 20-second sound bites and, you know, being grilled by, I don't know who, Chris Matthews or Wolf Blitzer.
You're right. And it is interesting that Thompson, I think, has immediately glommed onto the anti-immigration stance as one of his signature issues and a reminder of where the Republican Party is headed. So, I think, look, the field is wide open. There are four major candidates, you know, Giuliani, Thompson, McCain, and Romney.
And then, meanwhile,
there are a bunch more like Mike Huckabee.
Did you go to that luncheon for him the other day? I didn't get to it. Which he was
the one with E.J. Dionne? No,
yeah, the question was whether social conservatives. You have sung his praises here. Are you still hitting the high notes?
I'm still a fan. I still think that's the right approach to social policy as sort of a moderate, probably religiously inflected conservatism.
No.
Focusing on education, healthcare, and actually delivering results for people. Because I think part of the success of social policy is you have to care about the people you're trying to help, and it's not really been clear to me that bureaucrats do care about the people they're supposed to help. And yes. So you want to find people who really will go out there and sweat for them as well as spend money.
There's one part of politics that I often think, you know, gets neglected. That's what I'd call, you know, the performance end. And you have, you know, each side here, the Democrats and Republicans, some pretty high performers, and I mean just as candidates, just as politicians. You know, whether it's Giuliani, who, you know, was baptized in, you know, on the political cauldron of New York City, and then, you know, capitalized on 9/11. McCain, who's, you know, whose performance is down but had been high, and Romney, I think, is playing above his game. It's very, you know, Thompson, you know, has the Hollywood thing going for him. Very hard, I think, for, you know, a lot of these other second-tier candidates who've never played at this level to, you know, get in the ring and stay there. I thought Huckabee's comment the other day, you know, about many prisoners in America would like to be in Guantanamo was just, you know, was an example of that. Something that wouldn't sound bad, you know, while, you know, campaigning in Arkansas, while appearing on it, TV show, but you know, it just didn't seem presidential.
Well, okay, I'll put you down as up on the Huckabee.
But do you think? But I'm asking you. Do you think you can sort of, you know, rise?
Play above
his stats.
Jimmy Carter.
Well, yeah, Jimmy Carter. That was a very unusual year.
Well, they're all unusual in some way. He got nominated and he got elected. Now, some wise guy will say maybe he wasn't such a great president. That's another issue. But in terms of just the phenomenon of people coming out of nowhere and winning, Barry Goldwater, in a way. It's Bill Clinton in his own way. Look, I'm not trying to argue that anybody, including Huckabee, is a clinch for the nomination. I am merely echoing what you're saying, which is it's hard for me to think of a time when there have been three or four candidates or almost candidates who all are within striking distance of each other. And I would not minimize Romney. I think that anybody with that kind of money and that kind of look and that kind of organization is going to be a real contender all the way through January, February, whenever all these primaries start happening. And I'll remind you that none of us, certainly including I haven't, have figured out exactly who all this Super Tsunami Tuesday stuff helps. It is interesting that the wisdom of a week or two ago was, well, it'll help Iowa because Iowa comes first and there's 50 primaries or 30 primaries after that. Well,
forget Iowa.
Then you start seeing everybody skipping the
Ames store poll.
Is that in August? Yep. Which says maybe people are saying, look, yes, I won't compete in Iowa, or I won't compete very hard in Iowa, and then I'll focus on winning New York and California the next, I guess, a week later or 2 weeks later. Yeah. I mean, nobody knows. I mean, this is
of
all
Florida,
a poker
and actually
game.
Florida is making a move, too, to be early. I mean, so some schedules are even complete. On the Democratic side, the last debate for me crystallized what some of my own thoughts here. And looking at particularly Obama, he was, I thought, fine, adequate, maybe even good, maybe even inspiring, if that's your cup of tea. But it looked to me like he's still not able to overtake Hillary. She's a machine. She's a highly accomplished politician. She's doing everything she can to make sure there's no daylight between her and John Edwards and Obama on the war and on any other policy issue. And I think if, you know, for him to, you know, beat her, the front runner, he's going to have to kick it into a different gear and make a different type of case to the public. And he's really going to have to be, you know, close to explicit in why she's not good enough and I am. Just performing well on his own isn't going to do the trick.
I agree. And that's why, you know, Obama has to hope that, for example, Edwards derails Hillary and say Iowa, or has to hope that somehow this new Michael Moore movie, Sicko, you know, makes Hillary look bad, and that somehow hurts her, or some other number of scandals or biographies or something like that. I mean,
those are the big ifs, you know.
Those are. I mean, look, you'd have to. Hillary has kept her lead, and maybe even expanded it a little bit.
And the interesting thing is that there's a story in the Post saying that 60% of Democratic women are basically a lock for her, and that, you know, means that, you know, that now Obama is competing for a much smaller, you know, competing with her for a much smaller piece of the pie. If she starts off with 25% of the voting electorate, you know, women, Democratic women, then, you know, it changes the field and it makes you wonder if Obama, the only way he's going to beat her is if he really cuts her up. And I don't mean he has to be mean and vicious about it, but he's going to have to undermine her. And if he doesn't, is he playing for vice president? And if he tries to, you know, go after her more forcefully, does he then undermine his own appeal as a above-it-all, post-partisan type of candidate, who right now, in this L.A. Times Bloomberg poll I mentioned earlier, is the only Democrat who beats Giuliani, Romney, and McCain in head-to-head contests.